when we are flirting with that line, and believe me, so many of us do, and I think that most high-performing people do. This is where they are all the time because they like that edge. They like to be at their best, and their best is at that line. But how do we know before we cross the line? A lot of it is our sense of adrenaline. Again, for high-performing people, this is where it gets tricky because they love adrenaline. Adrenaline makes us superhuman. With adrenaline, why wouldn't I want to feel this?
Welcome to the Growth Mixtape Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Mathers. If you've ever felt like you should be doing something more with your life by now and are running out of time to do it, you're in the right place. I talk to ordinary people doing extraordinary things, and I leave you with two or three specific changes you can make to start living a bigger life right now. Today, we talk to Dr. Amy Apigian, a trauma and addiction specialist and author of the new book, The Biology of Trauma, that just landed at number 6 on USA Today's bestseller list. Now, if you're like me and recoil at the thought of a conversation about trauma for an hour, I get it. But I guarantee this is not what you're expecting. We talk about how trauma isn't something bad happening to you, but how your body responds to it and how it gets stored in the body long after the mind has moved on to create chronic disease and anxiety. But most importantly, we talk about how stress grows us, but it's trauma that breaks us. How to know when we're approaching the line between the two and how to increase the amount of healthy stress we can handle so we can continue to grow without getting overwhelmed and burned out. Give it a listen, and you'll see why this book is exploding. It's just what many of us need to hear right now. Please enjoy Dr. Amy Apigian.
I mean, that it's all very sudden. Maybe you haven't had time to reflect on it just yet, but what does your gut tell you about what's resonating about it?
The feedback that I've been getting from the book has been quite incredible. You know, you write a book and you're not sure how it's going to land for people. You know, the information is important. You know, the information is helpful, but did you write it in a way that is going to be able to pull the reader in and have them have an experience with the book and with themselves really as they're reading the book? And so the feedback that I've been getting has been so encouraging that, like, yes, I was able to write it in a way that's really landing for people. So I think it's the combination of the topic itself. I think that trauma is becoming a more mainstream conversation these days. And this idea that it really is looking at trauma and the body. There's not as much literature about trauma and the body. And I think that more and more people are making that connection in their own life with their own physical health, and then being able to have written a book that pulls people in with stories and with making the science accessible so that they feel like they are learning more about themselves than they've ever learned, and yet they've lived in their body their whole life.
Yes.
I don't know. It's kind of crazy to look at that USA Today list and to see Brené Brown, number 6. And, you know, like, she's a veteran New York Times bestselling author. She's number 6 for this last week, and I'm number 7. And I've never written a book before. This is my first book out. I'm a nobody. Nobody knows me. I am having this kind of pinch me incredible moment.
Yeah, I bet you are. I've got, you know, regular listeners to this podcast would know that I've got a huge crush on Brené Brown. Like, I just
don't we consume, all, right?
Yeah, I know. And I know she's got a new book, so I've been binging on some content. She's got a podcast out with her and Adam Grant, and they're always a blast to listen to. And what I think is so great about you slipping in just under her is Brené Brown could write anything and it would go to number 6.
It's true.
And the fact that you're right below her with your first ever book on trauma, which isn't something that you would think is going to fly off the shelves, it's a pretty heavy subject. That's a pretty amazing accomplishment.
Yeah. So we're sitting in that. Like, I literally just got the news about an hour ago. So.
Well, I'm excited to dig into this. Yeah, we started recording early. I haven't even welcomed you to the show. So welcome, Dr. Amy.
Well, thank you.
So there was a few things I was most excited about with the book. And, you know, just a bit of backstory. We got introduced through Mike Michalowicz, right? Who, who I had on the show and loved that conversation. And I asked him afterwards, hey, is there anybody else that you think might be a, you know, good fit for the podcast? And he came back with one name, and that was yours. And I immediately looked at it and said, biology of trauma, man, that sounds heavy. I don't know. But I said, I'm curious why Mike thought this would be such a good fit. And I got into your book, and it was revelatory in that I think we all come with a certain, I don't know, some baggage around the word trauma and whether we've had trauma and how we've dealt with it. And it turns out, yeah, I didn't really understand it at all. And as you said, this idea of carrying it around in our bodies, the whole, our whole lives, is something I really want to understand better.
Yeah. So I'm curious, like what related to you in the book? Like, what was it that you're like, oh, I didn't understand this before about trauma and my body?
Well, let's even start with the definition of trauma. Mm. So how do you define it? Because that was, I had never heard it described in that way before.
Yes. And, you know, it takes me back to when I realized that I actually didn't know anything about trauma. And I start my book with a story with my foster adopted son. And we're in a rocking chair. And I'm not going to give away the first line of the book. I will let readers enjoy that. But it takes me back to that time when I realized I thought I knew what trauma was. I thought I knew what children who had been through trauma needed. And I actually didn't have a clue. And so this idea that we can think we know something, and to the point where we're no longer even curious about it, we're not learning about it until something happens. And maybe for some readers, it'll be when they pick up this book. For me, it was in that rocking chair with my son realizing, I don't know what I'm missing. And so as I then went into my deep dive of trauma to help get answers for him, and then for myself, as I became sick with different chronic health issues, it really came down to a very simple definition, which is anything that for any reason at that time in our life overwhelmed our ability to process, to understand, to respond. And then there's layers deep to that. As I go into my book, here's what that looks like at the cellular level. Here's what that looks like at the system level, like our nervous system, our digestive system. So at the system level, here's what that looks like emotionally. And here's why even emotional triggers that go back to our attachment style can feel like life threats to me, that my body goes into a trauma response because it feels like that is too big for me to even understand, for me to process, for me to respond to. It's better for me just to hibernate and to shut down, to people please, to people fawn, to people fix, everything other than actually be able to respond to the situation in a way that would be helpful.
Something you said, I really loved, something that we think we understand so well, we're not even curious about anymore. And so when you started digging into this idea of trauma, were there things from your past that you realized were traumatizing? You just had never, I don't know whether you'd never put that label on it or had never dealt with it. How did you look back on some of the things in your life differently?
100%. I was looking at my childhood and comparing it to other people's childhood. And I was saying like, whoa, who am I to ever use the word trauma? I can look at even just my son. He came to me as a foster child at 4 years old. That's enough for you to be able to know that he had had such an awful childhood that he was already in the foster care system. And then what happens in the foster care system is also equally sometimes traumatizing because of all the different moves. By the time he got to me, he had been moved around 20 different times. So when I'm looking at my childhood, grew up with a family, always had the same family. We always had a roof over our head. I never had to worry about clothes, about food. Who am I? Who am I to say that I had trauma in my childhood. So it was never a word that I had related to. And it wasn't until I developed chronic health conditions, and for me that was weight gain and autoimmunity and chronic fatigue and anxiety and depression. That was my list. And I'm looking at my list and realizing every single one of those is associated with a research project that has been going on called the Adverse Childhood Experiences. Many people know about the ACEs and they have their ACE score. And in fact, I had patients who were coming to me and saying, but doc, this is the best that I can expect from my life because I have a high ACE score. And I know that I'm going to die early because that's what happens to the people who have a high ACE score. And so this idea that I never felt qualified to be able to use the word trauma, which then led me to downplay so much of the experiences that my body was still holding on to. And my mind was telling me, come on, Amy, you should be able to move on from this. You should be able to not have that affect you anymore. You should be able to show up with your family and not act like the little girl anymore, but the grown-ass woman that you are. So why do we do this? And being able to realize that even with all of my mindset, even with my conscious decisions, it hadn't translated into my body, and my body was still very much under the impact of a past that I was not aware of how significant it had been. As I am working with my adopted son, because I did decide to adopt him after foster parenting, he became a mirror to my own heart. And I realized that I was still very much carrying a past of being emotionally wounded. And my father was adopted. And so here I am now adopting. And I am realizing through the process that I had become or tried to become the one to take all of his pain away. Everyone who has been adopted, that was a significant trauma for them. I don't care at what age. And my father had been adopted at birth. Does not matter the age. That is a trauma. And never having processed it, he's still carrying this and bringing it into all of his relationships, including his relationship with me and my sisters. And the role that I decided, not really decided, but unconsciously had assumed as a child, as a young child, was it is my job to make him happy. And boy, did I try. And boy, did I fail. Because I can't make him happy. But as a child, I didn't know that. I thought I could. I thought I should. And so to look back and see all the things that I did, I became the accomplished one. Was always working, always studying, always trying to make him have something that he could be proud of, because then that would make him happy. And all that I put myself through in order to try to make someone else happy. That's a classic trauma response.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I want to come back to. I love that, Amy. Just before we go on, what is the ACE score? I don't know that.
Yeah, this is the Adverse Childhood Experiences. So it's just summarized as ACE. And this was actually a monumental research study that happened in medicine. It started in the 1980s with Dr. Vincent Folletti, a San Diego physician. He was an internal medicine physician. However, the United States government had done their research around mortality and morbidity, meaning what is getting people sick and what is getting people killed. And they said, you know what? We've determined the root cause of all of our issues, all of America's health issues. We have found the root cause. And everybody's sitting on the edge of their seat being like, well, what is it? What is it? And they said, obesity. So they said, Dr. Vincent Folletti, you are our guy. And we want you to develop a program that can go national that will address the obesity, because that will be the best preventive medicine for the whole nation. And so he did. He set out and he did. He created one of the best weight loss programs that had people losing over 100 pounds in a year. And it was so successful that they were all celebrating until their best patients started to drop out. Now, as every good scientist gets mad when their data is being messed with, he's like, what is going on? You can't drop out. You represent my best numbers. So he pulls them in and he's like, what's going on? Why are you dropping out? And not only have you dropped out, as I'm seeing you, you have regained all of your weight and more. Why? Tell me what's going on. And what they told him is a classic line that he told me, and it's always stuck with me. Dr. Filetti, what you think is the problem has been the solution to my problem. I find that as I lose weight, people are noticing me more. And I find out that I like to stay hidden. I don't like to be noticed. It feels dangerous to be seen. For other people, it was, as I lose weight, I feel less powerful. When I'm large, I feel strong and I feel like I can control my life. So that felt dangerous to them to lose weight. So all of these people had thought that they had wanted to lose weight. They thought that that's what they wanted. And as they did that, they realized it had just been a coping mechanism for hiding deeper trauma. And that's when he started asking them, well, what happened to you in your childhood? What happened to you in your earlier life that you think that being small or being hidden is dangerous? And that's when the stories of abuse came out. Many of them had had sexual abuse as a child. And that programming was still in their body, not their mind. Their mind hadn't recognized it. Their mind could say, we know you're no longer a child. But their body still had that association. It's called coupled. It was coupled with, this is dangerous. To be seen is dangerous. And so their body started to have these reactions, and their body would drive them back to the refrigerator, back to the cupboard, back to their way of living life that for them felt safer, even though it was unhealthy. So that's how the adverse childhood experiences even started. And then once that discovery was found that, oh my goodness, there's actually all of this abuse behind weight gain and obesity, then they started studying other conditions. And now, no joke, every single chronic health condition has been associated with adverse childhood experiences or trauma in childhood, whether they recognized it as trauma at the time or not.
Yeah, there's so much in there to unpack. But that last part that you said is interesting because as you said, I mean, I look back at my life and I've had some sad things happen to me. I wouldn't call them traumatizing because, like you said, I've heard stories of people with truly traumatic stories. And I'm like, oh, well, I have nothing to complain about. And even when you've got the research that links mortality and morbidity to obesity and then back to these early trauma experiences, traumatic experiences, I imagine even those people didn't recognize that as trauma at the time. So it sort of explodes almost anything that happens in your childhood, or I guess any time in your life, that overwhelms your ability to process it is traumatic, which kind of coming back to what I was saying early on, I guess, kind of exploded my mind in terms of what trauma really is. And it makes like, I guess I probably do have more trauma coursing through my veins than I ever thought.
And this is what I want people to see. I want people to be able to just recognize that, oh, I may have downplayed experiences, not realizing the impact that it's had on my body, not just my mind, my actual body, my biology, because then that's when we can move into action. Once people know that they have had trauma, then they can do something about it, not just understand it as something that becomes heavy and depressing. No, we have repair tools, and now you know that you need them, as opposed to not even knowing that you need them, and the damage is still accumulating underneath the surface, and that's what we can prevent. We can actually go in and repair mind, body, and biology so that we can actually be free from the impact of our past.
Yeah, there's something to removing the stigma around even the term trauma as well, that I imagine, like the more we talk about it and the more books that are written like this, where we can have conversations outside of our therapist office and just admit that we've all had it. We've all had things happen in our life that overwhelmed our ability to process them. And if that's trauma, then we're all carrying it around.
That's my hope. And so as I was writing the book, I am giving the readers language for them to be able to use. And I've started to hear them use this language already. Like, oh, I just went into my freeze response. I'm like, yes, we're speaking that language. Or, hey, I'm about to cross my critical line of overwhelm. I should walk away right now. Like, yes. Like, once we understand these five steps that our body takes, that takes us into this trauma state, this trauma response, then we can notice where we are in that process and get off of those train tracks and create a very different experience for ourselves. If we don't know this, we continue doing the same thing, which is get stressed, go into overwhelm, and we're only escalating the underlying damage to our biology as a result.
Hey, it's Bob, and I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of keynote speeches inspired by the stories of my amazing guests. At their core, these signature talks are about how to get you and your teams off autopilot and stop settling for small incremental improvements. This isn't going to come from spewing business advice. My podcast is full of people that have done incredible things, and every one of them struggles with self-doubt, imposter syndrome, and the crippling fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. They've also found ways through it by rediscovering their creativity, their curiosity, and the confidence to do scary things. Imagine the power of bringing these vulnerable stories to life, live and on stage, to help you and your teams hit your targets, find your voice, and be the rock stars you are. Book me for your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show. And I do love the story and the connection with your son, because I've got two sons. They're in their early 20s now. And I think what you said was, you know, he was a mirror to your heart. I've never heard it describe as beautifully as that. But I do find that I go back and see my childhood through a different lens, watching them go through it. But I also find like conversations like this are kind of like overwhelming. Like, oh my God, what have I done to them? Like what trauma have I put them through that I didn't recognize as trauma? And how many years in therapy are they going to spend because of the things that I did to them? So it's great, but it's also like, yeah, it also overwhelms me with this sense of responsibility and things I wish I had known earlier.
Maybe instead of that college fund, we should be funding a therapy fund.
Yeah. Yes. And nobody gets out of it. Look, you might not think you need it now, but you're going to need it at some exactly. point. So you're going to thank me later.
Yeah. You know, because I sat with that and I realized the impact that this will have on parents to be able to see truly the definition of trauma and be able to now recognize when their children are going into this response in this state. And I sat with it trying to figure out how do I not depress parents, and how do I still give them that, no, like, here's what you can do about it. And the way that I wanted to present it to them was very much as, and this is what I go into in chapter 11, the filter that we all have, and that because of our filter, each one of us is doing the best that we can with what we have. Each one of us. And so as we look back at what we've done in our past, and I can look back in my past and see a lot of things that I did wrong with my son. So many things that I did wrong, just not understanding. And rather than beat myself up, I can look back and have compassion on myself and him. I can be like, oh, poor kid. And I can have compassion on myself because I can see how I was doing my best at that time, given the support that I had, the information that I had, the financial resources that I had. And so every moment we have this background calculation that's happening. Again, in my book, chapter 11, we call it neuroception, this idea that our nervous system is constantly calculating, how should I be in this moment that will best help me in my survival? And when times are good and we feel in a place of abundance, then we're coming from a place of security, and we will always be acting in our best self. We will be in our best health. We will be our best parent for ourselves, reparenting ourselves and for our children. So that's the state that we can always expect that outcome. And it's when we are stressed or we are overwhelmed. Both of those are survival responses. And that is when we will be making decisions that are coming from a place of scarcity, coming from a place of desperation, coming from a place of, I don't know if I'm going to be okay. I don't know if my family is going to be okay. And the decisions that we make from that place are always different than the decisions that we make when we're coming from a place of abundance. It's not bad. It's not good. It just is what it is. But being able to look back and say, I was doing the best that I could at that time with what I had. And now I can learn to do better. I can learn to come from a place of security. I can learn to come from a place where I'm feeling calm and I've resourced myself so that I'm not making decisions or parenting from that place of fear and scarcity and desperation.
Yeah, that gets into some of the things you lay out in the book about how we can alleviate these symptoms or address this. And I want to do that, but I want to come back to a couple of things that you've touched on. You talk about the difference between stress that helps us grow and trauma that breaks us. I'd really love to dig into that before we sort of get into the what to do about all this.
Stress can grow us. Trauma is what breaks us. So I see that you've got some guitars behind you. Do you play?
Yes.
I love that. So every tissue has its breaking point. Every string has its breaking point. And when you play those strings, you're stressing them because you are moving them in such a way that they're stretching, and that's how they make noise, and that's how they make a song, and that's how they play a melody, and it's beautiful. But if you pull that string past its point, well, then it will break. And when it breaks, it's not going to play any song for you. It's not going to play any note for you. It's not going to be able to play any melody for you. So that's the same thing with us. When we have things that stretch us, that challenge us, but we stay within what I call our window of capacity. So even though it's hard, I can be present in it. I can stay with it. I can continue to respond to it and think of, what do I need to do now? What should I do now? But it's when I cross a line that's the breaking point. I've crossed a line that now it's not going to do anything productive for me. It's now just going to sit there. It's now just going to hibernate and wait until it feels that the danger is over. So I had a patient, Kenneth, and he came in. He was a veteran. He came in. He had been lifting weights that morning, as many veterans do, in order to channel their trauma, their stored trauma. So he's in the gym. He's lifting weights. It was any other day. But today, he had a less capacity. Whatever the situation was, his capacity was less than usual. Not realizing that and not being connected with his body to be able to feel that, he's trying to lift the same amount of weight to grow his muscles. Well, he comes into the emergency room and his bicep is in the middle of his arm. It's no longer attached to his shoulder like it should be. And so in looking at this, he had crossed that line. Rather than having those weights grow his muscles, it had broken his muscles that morning. That's the difference. And in within each of us, we also have our line between, yeah, this is hard, but I can respond to it, versus this feels so big that my body is just caving in, collapsing, and saying, there's no way we can successfully overcome this. We shouldn't even try. There's a fascinating research study that was done back in the 1960s with a psychologist. Seligman was his name. And he did a study on, well, what they found was, what they were learning about was learned helplessness. Learned helplessness. How interesting is it? So he takes a group of dogs And half of the group, he ties them to a wall with their harness so that they can't jump over a low barrier that he has. And on then one side where the dogs are, he puts a mat that creates electrical shocks. On the other side of this barrier is no mat. They are safe. They are not going to get shocked. So these dogs, half of them are now tied to the wall where this electrical mat is. He turns on the mat. So now all of the dogs are getting shocked. For the dogs who are not harnessed, this is a stress for them, but they're like, let me try to escape. What do I need to do? And they jump over the wall and they get to the other side and they're like, ah, danger's over. I can return to a sense of safety. However, the dogs who were tied up to the wall, they try to jump, but they can't. And they continue to get shocked. And now all of a sudden, this has become an inescapable life threat. They think they're going to die by being shocked. So this is inescapable. They can't. They've tried and they can't. And it feels like a life threat. Those same dogs, he puts all of them together on the same in the same container. This time he does not tie up any of them. They are all free. He turns on the electrical mat and the shocks start happening. For those dogs who had been through this before and had been able to jump over the barrier, this was not even a stress for them because they'd seen this before. They know this. They know what happens. They know how to escape. It's more of an inconvenience. It's annoying, but it's not even a stress because they know what to do. They jump over the barrier and they're fine. The dogs who had not been able to jump over before, did they even try? No. They had been programmed to believe, you could say that. You could also look at it at a muscle tissue level that had taken on this belief. It was holding this experience from the past that said, you can't. There's something wrong about you. There's something broken about you. You're defective. And those dogs laid on the mat and started whimpering, even though they were free to jump. So this is how trauma actually gets programmed and wired into us, even at that tissue level, where we as people don't even try anymore to overcome a challenge because we've been in challenges before. We've been through hard things before, and we've come to believe that we can't do hard things or we can't feel big feelings. And maybe we experience a loss. Someone significant to us passes away, or a pet passes away, or we didn't accomplish something that we really had worked hard for. There's a grief associated with that. And we have come to believe and to have the experience in our past that those kinds of feelings are too big for us to feel. We shouldn't even try. And so we end up just shutting down in defeat and going into depression rather than being able to sit with our grief, feel it, and move through it, and then move through the other side into joy and renewed purpose and other relationships and connection. But when we have these programmed beliefs that have become part of our tissues and part of our body, we continue to believe that there's something wrong with us, something wrong with me. And I shouldn't even try because I know that I'm going to fail. So why even try? I don't know. Does this make any sense?
Oh, it, yes. And I mean, I feel it all the time. I talk to people all the time. I haven't heard it framed that way, but certainly I think we can all relate to looking at other people and the success that they've achieved and be like, yeah, that I just couldn't do that. And I've never thought of it in terms of shutting down, but certainly there have been times, I think, in all of our lives where we didn't try something because we thought for sure that we would fail. That kind of success is only meant for other people. And and it's overwhelming. So that absolutely, Dr. Amy, I love that. The thing that you talked about the window. I'd love to understand that better. How do we know what our window is? Like, how do we know that I can work within this window? I want to stay in this window. Maybe I want to increase this window so that I don't get to that critical line of overwhelm. And how do I know once I've crossed it? Does that make sense?
It makes so much sense. And this is the big question, right? Like, okay, if I no longer want to go into overwhelm or this trauma state, then how do I know that I'm even approaching that, that I can avoid it? This window of capacity, is going to include both our what we would call parasympathetic or rest and digest state, where we are feeling perfectly calm and feeling perfectly safe and secure. And this is when we are creative and connected. So it includes that, because that's definitely within our window of capacity to manage those emotions and those responses. But it also includes this stress. And really, it depends on how much stress can you hold and still respond to in a healthy way. Once we get to a point where, okay, you can no longer hold that much, now we're going to cross that line. So we're looking at, well, how much stress can a person hold? It's not even just stress. We call it activation. So this idea that our nervous system gets activated, and it can be activated with a challenge. Maybe we're running a marathon. This has nothing to do with danger, but it's still an activation of our nervous system. And how much activation can it hold? How much joy can a person hold? It's been surprising for many people coming through my courses to realize that joy has not felt safe to feel, because it then triggers all of this other stuff. It seems to poke into our grief and our sadness, and we don't want that. So we temper how much joy we allow ourselves to feel. So how much can we hold is our window of capacity. Now, this is actually also happening at the physiological level. And in medicine, we have this term called homeostatic window, which is the window, the range in which my body, my nervous system, my autonomic nervous system can fine-tune and make pivots in my blood chemistry. All of this is the window in which my body says, yep, I can keep things functioning for you. I gotcha. So that's what our window of tolerance is, or our window of capacity is, our ability to respond. I think of it as out surfing the waves on the ocean. And what's the size of the wave that you have the capacity for and not get tossed off your board? What is the size of the wave that will toss you over? What is the size of the wave that will crush you, that will overwhelm you? Well, if we were out on the ocean, out on our board, could we have a sense of, whoa, that wave looks too big. I should wait that one out. That's not for me yet. You have a sensation in your body that says, I'm approaching what feels like panic. I'm approaching what feels like terrifying. And our body will tell us that. The problem is that most people are not connected to their body. They're not getting these messages from their body, which means that they're ignoring the messages. They're overriding the messages. They're trying to tell their body, I don't care how you feel. We're going to do this because my mind wants to do this. And our body is saying, I'm telling you, we don't have the capacity for this. And what happens is that when we are then in any kind of a situation, whether it's emotional or whether it's physical, like we're out on the ocean waves, or whether it's biochemical and we're being exposed to toxins that are just too many and too much, our body says, well, we've exceeded our capacity, and now we need to have a different survival strategy. No longer is the survival strategy to, well, try to stay up on your board. No, that's going to just make it worse. We should just give up, lie down on our board, or get into the ocean and give up. And then we'll, you know, try again later on. So this idea that if we were connected with our body, we would be able to recognize when something feels like a stress that, yeah, I got this. Let me give it my best. I can do this, versus I don't think we can do this. And we should really be pulling back And I'm not listening to my body though. And that's when we're getting into the overwhelm and this trauma state, is because we're not listening to our body.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple things about that that really strike me, Dr. Amy. One is that the problem for me is always that I don't know what waves I can handle until I try one that I can't handle. So it's like, you got to cross that line and be like, whoop, that's too much. Yeah. It's not like I get to live in this comfortable window that you talk about. It's sort of like I'm always flirting with that line. So what are the signs when you talk about the signals that your body is sending you? Like, how do I listen to my body better to know when I'm approaching that line so I don't have to keep stepping over it to find out the hard way?
And I want to make sure that people know that it's not bad to go into a trauma response. It's one of the innate designs of our body. So it's not bad. What is damaging is when we then stay in that state and it becomes chronic. Like, we don't know how to resolve that experience. We don't know how to complete that experience. And so then it lingers. And now we're back to talking about how our body is holding on to things from even decades ago. That's what we want to also learn, how to complete this response, so it doesn't become just one more thing that my body is holding on to in a chronic state. So when we are flirting with that line, and believe me, so many of us do, and I think that most high performing people do, this is where they are all the time, because they like that edge. They like to be at their best, and their best is at that line. So we know that line. We know what it feels like to cross that line often, but how do we know before we cross the line? How do we know before we cross that line? A lot of it is our sense of adrenaline. Now, again, for high performing people, this is where it gets tricky, because they love adrenaline. They love the feeling of adrenaline. Adrenaline makes us superhuman, makes me super smart, because it drives blood to my brain. So I'm more focused than what I usually am. I'm stronger because it's taking blood to my muscles. So I'm superhuman with adrenaline. Why wouldn't I want to feel this? So that's why we tend to flirt with this line, because what makes the difference between what I can handle and what is going to overwhelm me is the amount of adrenaline. So get this, inside of our body, we have our nervous system that is constantly calculating the perception that we have of the size of the demands and the danger that we are facing. Based on our perception of the size is the amount of adrenaline that will get released. So if it's a small problem, I receive an email and there's a problem, but it's relatively easy. I just need to make a few phone calls. I need to do this. I know what I need to do. Well, then just the amount of adrenaline is released for me to be able to do those things, but not have all of this excess adrenaline that's going to cause you damage. But if I perceive a big danger, that's a lot of adrenaline that my body is going to release, because my body is going to say, then you need to be this superhuman to overcome this size of danger. But when that adrenaline goes to our cells are looking at the size of the danger through the adrenaline that's now surrounding it. And it will say, look, I understand that this is what you want me to do. I can't do that for you. I can't do that level for you. You're asking me to make so much more energy and you need it in the next 5 seconds. I can't. And so it's really a cellular decision that makes us cross that line where our cells are saying, I can't make the amount of energy that you're asking me to make based on the amount of adrenaline that you have just released. And so in order to keep you alive, we have now exceeded our homeostatic capacity, or my capacity to be able to regulate all of these blood chemistry levels and CO2 and oxygen and all the things that our body does for us. I can't regulate that with this amount of adrenaline. And so the best survival strategy is for me to just shut everything down. And it's literally like our body pulling on the emergency brake. It won't let us respond. It releases cytokines and chemokines in our brain that creates this immediate brain fog so that even if we wanted to think clearly, we can't. It creates a sense of heaviness in our muscles so that even if we wanted to outrun the tiger, we can't. And so our body is doing everything it can to immobilize us, which is why we call it the freeze response. This is where we see if someone is in some type of real danger, maybe like a robbery, they end up just handing everything over that they're asking for. They're no longer fighting them. They are doing exactly what the robbers are asking them to do, not because they actually want to, but because their body says it's no use to fight. It's more dangerous to fight in this situation, and we just need to go along. And in our kind of the equivalent in the animal kingdom is play dead. Just play dead. So it really is all so much dependent on the amount of adrenaline that's released, which is fascinating that it comes down to adrenaline and our perception, not reality, our perception of the size of the danger that's happening right now.
Yeah, that's a lot. So there's a lot about that that I like. So I understand, I think the window, I love that idea of flirting with that line and recognizing some of the symptoms of stepping over it. So how do we stay in that pocket, or what are some of the things that we can do to either stay in that pocket, maybe grow that window? And then what do we do once we step over it and we find ourselves overwhelmed, we're shutting down? How do we manage all of this?
Yeah. Well, let's start there, because actually when we come out of that shutdown, people pleasing, people fawning state, we are going to go back into stress. So let's talk about when we do find ourselves in that state of, and I'll just call it heaviness now. When we find ourselves in that state of really low energy, there's three things that it needs to come out. It needs energy, it needs safety, and it needs time. So when I notice my body having gone into that place, I liken it to a turtle that's retreated back into its shell. There had been a danger and the turtle had been trying to crawl away, but the danger was too much and the turtle realized, no, I can't outcrawl this danger. The best thing for me is just to retreat into my shell. So what does the turtle need in order to come out? Well, it needs to know that the danger is over, right? It needs to know that there's true safety for it to even poke its head out. It also needs energy, because it needs the energy to be able to do that. It takes energy to move. So if it's going to pop its head out and start walking again, it needs the energy to do that. And when we go into this heavy state, that our metabolism, our energy does get affected, it gets slowed down, so we don't have the energy. And then we need time. And many people don't realize this. Our body goes on some kind of timer, where once it crosses that line, it's like it's been stunned. And why is it stunned? It's stunned because I can't believe what just happened. I can't believe that I'm stuck. I can't believe that there's nothing else that I can do here. I can't believe this. So there's this element of being stunned, and that just takes time to come out of being stunned. So we don't give ourselves a true sense of safety. We don't allow ourselves the time to just rest or hibernate or be in this low energy state. It's uncomfortable for us. So we try to bring in stimulants. We try to drink more coffee. We try to eat more sugar or carbohydrates in order to have that fast energy. We do everything to not give ourselves our body the time that it needs. And then this idea of energy. Many of us are now running on nutrient imbalances, deficiencies. We're not eating well, even when we're not in this state. So by the time we go into this state, then our body already has maybe a magnesium deficiency or a zinc deficiency. I mean, there's so many deficiencies that will impair our body's ability to bounce back faster and have the energy that it needs to come out of this state. So it's interesting then to look at those aspects of our biology and how they really do impact and interface with this emotional state. But when we do come out, what happens is that our body retraces the steps that it took to get in. And so many people think that when they come out of this heaviness and depression and low energy state, that they're going to be able to come back immediately right into parasympathetic, which is your feeling calm and alive and connected. And that's not true. The body retraces its steps. So you're going to come out into that anxiety that overwhelmed you and put you into the low heavy or the low energy state. So as we come back out, now we're in this state again. And if we don't know what to do, we're going to cross the line again. That's what many people do. Then they just get into a loop and they're always living in either stress or overwhelm. So when we are in that stress and we have not crossed that line yet, what do we need to do? And how do we grow that window of capacity so that we can hold more and not cross that line? This is the idea of support. And when we have support, we can go through very hard things and not cross the line. I think of people perhaps in the military and they are in a war zone. And if they have someone next to them, if they have someone who has their back, if they have someone who's by their side, they can go through very hard experiences and it not be a trauma that breaks them and they come back with PTSD. It's the feeling all alone in something that makes it become overwhelming. And so how can I bring in support so that I can grow my window of capacity and not go into overwhelm? Well, I can become that for myself. So I can start to listen to my own body. So what I do is I start to create pauses throughout a stressful situation, be like, just checking in. How is my body feeling with this? Is it feeling like it's still resourced? Is it feeling like it's going into overwhelm soon? So that I'm in it with my body as opposed to feeling all alone in something. I'm also resourcing myself with looking at who can I bring in with me? Is there, even if it's just a friend, okay, having a friend who knows what's happening still has me not feeling alone. And then we're expanding our window of capacity by intentionally bringing in this support. How am I feeding my body? Am I hydrating my body? Am I still getting the rest that I need so that I can maintain whatever stress I need to maintain and not cross into overwhelm? So it's all this idea of resourcing myself and supporting myself so that I have a larger window of capacity.
Yeah, so you talked about pauses. I really like that. In the book, you also talked about something, and honestly, I had to look it up. What's a somatic self-practice? What's an example of something that people could use? I felt bad. I felt like this is something I probably should know what it was, but I had to look it up.
No, most people don't. And that's why I'm bringing this in, is because so many people don't know these resources that we have. So I'm going to invite you to just bring your hands up to your shoulders as close as possible. We're going to just do one right now and you're going to experience what it's like. All right. Now I want you to imagine that there's a huge rock in front of you. In fact, go ahead and feel this huge rock. It's huge. You feel how thick it is too? Oh my goodness. All right. Well, we're going to need to push this rock away. So as you bring your hands back to your shoulders, we're going to push this rock away. I'm bracing my legs, my hips, and we can start pushing, but this rock is so heavy, it's so thick, we have to go very, very slow. And in fact, I have people go as slow as they can. Some people can't go slow because their muscles start to fatigue and they wish that they'd been going to the gym and working out because their muscles are fatiguing, but we go as slow as we can and we push this heavy rock away. And then when we get to full arm extension, just pause for a moment there. And when it feels right, you can let your arms rest. Whew, I just get a deep breath with that. What are you noticing?
Yeah, I would say maybe a calmness.
A calmness. Yeah. Where do you feel that calmness?
In my chest and my arms and my shoulders. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm noticing that your shoulders dropped a little bit. Did you notice that?
Yeah, I guess so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, isn't this lovely? Isn't this, this is a somatic self-practice. And we know the anatomy, we know the physiology, that even just pushing something away creates what feels like space. And space feels like a little bit of safety. So this is one example of a somatic self-practice.
This is definitely a conversation, Dr. Amy, that I'm going to be reflecting on for a while. It's so, so much richer than even I was expecting. There's a couple things that I love about it. One, I think I can look back on as early as early childhood, but just in my past with a different lens. I think I've got some new tools in my everyday life to recognize this window, the stress, the adrenaline, the overwhelm. But I also think too, I wonder, and I'm hoping that it better arms me for things that are coming. And I love that past, present, future kind of lens. And I'm starting to realize why this is number 7 on the bestseller list, because I have a feeling this is resonating with people far beyond kind of the audience that you originally wrote it for.
Yeah, I really wrote it so that people could have a manual for their body, for their nervous system, and to be able to understand it so they can work with it. But we weren't given a manual for here's how your body works. It was just like, well, good luck. And we've we've been doing our best, but boy, to be able to have a manual to understand even our own reactions and our own responses, and be able to have then a roadmap for if I wanted to change my responses, how would I do that? Well, this is it. Working with our nervous system that drives our survival.
The book is called The Biology of Trauma. So I assume people can find it wherever they get their amazing books. Where else can they find you, Dr. Amy, if they want to learn more?
Yeah, they can find me at biologyoftrauma.com. And in fact, I have some free resources that I'm sharing that go with the book if they want to go to biologyoftrauma.com/book.
This has been just eye-opening, so thought-provoking. Like I said, I know I'm going to be reflecting on this. It's going to spark some conversations, probably that I never thought I'd have with my friends. And I just can't thank you enough. This has been amazing.
Ah, well, thank you. Really appreciate it.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.